Information 55. Radio 55 brings you an in-depth look at the characteristics of our times through conversation with those who shape them. Information 55.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Information 55. I'm John Rodell, and we have as our guest this evening the Honorable Thomas F. Eagleton, Senator from the state of Missouri. We want to welcome you, Senator. It's a pleasure to have you. First time on Information 55.
Well, John, you've been inviting me to appear on this fine program for several months now, and I apologize not being able to work out a convenient time, but I'm glad to be with you tonight, and let's go at it.
All right. We want to get all the information that we can from you, Senator. First, let's talk about housing. That's a local issue, very big here in St. Louis. What about federal monies coming into our local housing?
Well, we're in a very desperate situation here in St. Louis. Six very worthwhile and necessary housing projects, including DeSoto Carr and others, have been stymied in the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I've talked to Secretary Lynn's office, the Secretary of HUD, and we hope to meet this week in Washington, Senator Symington, myself, Congressman Clay, and Congresswoman Sullivan, with Mayor Pelker in Secretary Lynn's office to see if we can get these housing projects moving. They're on dead center, they're dormant, and they are necessary and vital. I do want to point out for the listening audience, though, that the condition here in St. Louis is typical of that around the country. St. Louis isn't just being picked out and abused. It's not a question of us being picked on. This policy of a freeze on all housing projects throughout the is nationwide in scope. It's Cleveland, it's Chicago, it's New York. So we have a tough chore to try to convince Secretary Lynn to let us go forward on these St. Louis projects, but all we can do is try.
Is it because the money isn't there?
It's not only the money is there. Congress has appropriated the money. It's the president doesn't want to spend it. The Office of Management and Budget has certain priorities in spending that differ from the Congress, quite frankly. We intend that this money be spent. In fact, there are lawsuits pending contesting the authority of the president to impound monies when the Congress already appropriated. The power of the purse under the Constitution, we believe, belongs to the Congress, and that we think the president is acting illegally and improperly in impounding these funds, but we're taking him to the courts on that. We've won every case thus far at the trial level, but we haven't gotten a case high enough up on the appellate level to pry the money loose.
You mentioned a subject right there about the president being all-powerful. Is Congress asserting itself more today, do you think, to get their power back, the power that they've let the president usurp from them through the years?
Yes, indeed, Congress is in two very key and vital areas. One we've just mentioned in passing this impoundment, the power to spend, the authority to raise and spend monies. I reiterate that we believe is a congressional authority given to us by the Constitution. We're trying to recapture that lost power by challenging the president on the concept of impoundment. The other major area in which we're trying to recapture our authority is in war making. The Constitution, again, gives to Congress, not the president, John, but to Congress, the authority to decide how, when, why, and where we go to war. Only Congress, not the president. Hamilton wrote that section of the Constitution. He didn't want to have one man make the decision as to war. He thought that was too important to be left to one man, be he a king or a president. He wanted it to be a collective decision. And we passed the War Powers Act. It's an act authored by Senator Stennis, Senator Javits, and myself in the Senate by an overwhelming vote, and where it's being considered over in the House, which would restore the war-making decision to where it originally belonged and put it in the hands of the Congress.
Well, the last time Congress had anything to do about declaring war was 1941, wasn't it?
That's right, the Second World War. Korea basically was an undeclared war. We fought that under the theory of the UN Charter, and of course Vietnam was fought under the aegis of the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, but it was not officially a declared war in that sense.
You don't think Congress will ever let this happen again?
Well, I should hope that the experience of Vietnam, that what would be such as to never permit us to let that reoccur, that if the decision is to be made that we go to war, it ought to be an open decision, openly arrived at with a vote taken and a war declared, if that be the judgment, if that be considered the wise move. But we shouldn't just sort of drift into war by osmosis.
Another important bill before the Senate, Senator Eagleton, is the Military, Army, and Supply Bill, the procurement bill.
Correct.
What's going to happen there?
That'll come up for final passage tomorrow, John, in Washington, and will probably pass by an overwhelming vote. I'll support it, there, and so will Senator Symington. He's the chairman of the Armed Services Committee now because of the illness of Senator Stennis. There are many things in that bill that neither Senator Symington nor I are very satisfied with. The Trident submarine program is being speeded up at a rate that I think will be almost self-defeating. It'll cost millions and billions of dollars, maybe billions of cost overruns, because we're foolishly, in my judgment, and Senator Symington's as well, trying to speed it up. There's the AWACS air warning system that I think is unnecessary that's in the bill. But you see, on final passage, you have to take it or leave it. And we have to have an armed service procurement bill. There are certain weapon systems that must go forward, like the F-15 bomber or fighter plane, is necessary. Other equipment that is contained in the bill. And just because there are some individual provisions that I find distasteful, on balance, I've got to look at the bill as a whole.
In other words, you're not going to be cutting any of the monies in the bill, none of the appropriations.
There'll be one final attempt made by Senator Humphrey late Monday afternoon to try to cut the Senate version of the bill back to the House spending level. The Senate version, as now on the floor, is I think, close to $1 billion higher than the House version. He will make one final attempt to cut that back. It's anticipated that that vote will be very close. I'll support Senator Humphrey on that amendment.
But if it passes, then this is a victory for the president.
I would say it would have to be so considered, especially the Trident. That was the that was the single most contentious military issue. That's the debate that took 2 or 3 days, and it was a very close vote. What was it? I think 2 or 3 votes, 49 to 46, a very close margin. But the president's position did prevail. So you're in the business of analyzing the news and interpreting the news. I think you would be fair in making such an analysis to say it was a victory for President Nixon.
Let's turn now, if we might, Senator, to the United Nations. Is the United States supporting the United Nations as much as it should?
Well, indeed, I think it is. Some think that we're supporting it more than we should. Up as of now, we're still paying over 25% of the overall operating costs of the United Nations. And we have passed a bill in the Congress, and I think properly so, to limit our total expenditure in the UN to 25%. I think your question was twofold, really. It wasn't just the dollars in terms of support, but it was also, are we giving it the moral support that it deserves? I think we are. I must be candid and say this. The United Nations has not lived up to the high and great expectations that many of us had for it from the time it was conceived back in San Francisco in 1945 at the end of World War II. At that time, it was viewed as the forum in which debates into international matters would be held and resolutions would be resolved. Decisions would be made resolving disputes, preventing wars, etc. It hasn't on the overall succeeded. We've had some wars since 1945. We mentioned two earlier in this broadcast, Korea and Vietnam, to say nothing about the wars in Africa, to say nothing about Nigeria and Biafra, to say nothing about India-Pakistan, to say nothing about the Arab-Israeli disputes through the years, etc. So the UN has frankly just not been able to fulfill the function for which it was designed. And part of that reason is nationalism. No nation, including the United States, wants to surrender its sovereignty. The Russians don't, we don't, Great Britain doesn't, certainly France doesn't. And as long as we each are so proudly possessive of our own sovereignty, the UN will probably just remain as an intriguing debating forum and be little else.
You think it's as strong or weaker now than the League of Nations was?
Well, the League of Nations, you see, was really almost shot down from the outset. It was crippled before it was even born by the refusal of the United States Senate to ratify the United States' participation in the League of Nations. Thus, one of the giant powers of the world opted out of the League even before it got underway. So I'd have to say that the United Nations, albeit rather weak, is still, even in its weakness, a bit stronger than the League of Nations.
Something that's been in the news for quite some time, Senator Eagleton, and that's the wheat that we've been sending to Russia. There's the Jackson Amendment to the trade bill. I wonder if you'd explain that to us. We have a newspaper strike here in St. Louis. We're not duly informed as we should be sometimes.
Well, let me answer really two questions there. You talked about the wheat deal and the Jackson Amendment. They're separate issues, and let me address myself first to the wheat deal, if I may. I saw in the Wall Street Journal a week before last a little tiny item, and I almost went through the roof. The Russians on the Rome Grain Exchange sold American wheat at 3 times the price they paid for it. Now here's Soviet Union, the Bolsheviks with bombs and what have you, and here we are, the great commercial nation, the great free enterprise nation. We're supposed to be sharp in finance and trade. They bought wheat, you recall, last year, a fourth of our wheat, at bargain basement prices, subsidized by federal tax dollars, and are selling it this year in Rome for three times what they paid for it. Well, further, I don't have to add any more to it. That was just a colossal mistake that wheat deal last year. And we're paying for it not only in terms of the cost of that wheat last year, but we're paying for it every day in the supermarket. Your wife and my wife, when she goes to Kroger or Safeway, and I don't want to, all the good stores, and pays 50, 54 cents for a loaf of bread. That was last year's Russian wheat deal. All right, the Jackson Amendment. There is pending before the United States Congress a bill which would give to the Soviet Union what is called most favored nation status. There are two categories of nations in the world, insofar as U.S. trade is concerned. There's most favored nation, that means, quote, friendly people that we trade with, and they can then get low-interest loans, can avail themselves of World Bank loans, etc., and have greater access to trade in the United States. Then there's a category of nations that don't have that, which would be the Soviet Union at the present time. The People's Republic of China does not have it. Bulgaria does not have it. Czechoslovakia does not have it. Hungary does not have it, etc. The Russians very much want to be designated most favored nation to avail themselves of greater trade opportunities vis-a-vis the United States. Senator Jackson of Washington is offering an amendment to that proposal, which says, okay, Soviet Union, you want that most favored nation thing, okay, we'll consider giving it to you. But we put an amendment on here saying that you must live up to your obligations as a United Nations member and permit immigration from the Soviet Union of any peoples who want to immigrate. That's guaranteed in the UN Charter. That's sort of a precept of international mankind. And you must permit, in this instance specifically, the Jews who want to leave the Soviet Union, you must permit them to leave. So that's where we are asking that of you. In exchange for this most favored nation treatment, I'll support the Jackson Amendment.
You think it will pass?
Well, it has, I think, over 70 sponsors in the Senate. That's a strong indicator that it should. It takes 51 votes to have a majority, so I think close to 70 or so have signed the Jackson Amendment. So, yes, I should think it would.
Oh, could we talk just a little bit about Phase 4? It's a complicated subject, I know, but when will the consumer get a break with prices? Do you think prices are going to ever come down again, Senator?
Oh, ever, yeah. Yeah. When you ask the question that way, John, say we're ever going to come down, yeah. But soon and in the immediately foreseeable future, no. Secretary of Agriculture Butts predicts beef prices will come down starting very, very soon. I think this is another erroneous prediction by Secretary Butts, who, by the way, conceived that magnificent Russian wheat deal that I told you about. He's the one that thought we had all that surplus wheat last year and when we were in deficit, so he was wrong then. I think, sadly, he's wrong now. Based on conversations I've had with farmers, including the leaders of the Missouri Farmers Association and other interested farm groups, they don't expect cattle prices to be turning downward in the immediate future. I wish I could bring happier news to your viewing audience or listening audience, but I can't. That's my best judgment.
Yesterday afternoon, Vice President Agnew gave a speech before the National Federation of Republican Women out in California. It was a fiery speech. Some of the NBC commentators that were there said it was one of the fieriest political speeches they've heard in some time. I think the man was, in some ways, really fighting for his political life. He said that he would not resign if indicted. He got a standing ovation just on that one comment. He blames, as we all know, the Justice Department for the many leaks on his case. Do you think this is true and a valid statement by the Vice President?
I think the Vice President has very substantial grounds for some of the criticism he's made of the Justice Department. I think he ought to broaden his criticism to include the White House. John, leaks have been coming out of both the White House and the Justice Department fast and furious now for several weeks. Almost daily, there's some, quote, high-level source in the White House or high-level source in the Justice Department saying this or that about the Vice President. I think this is an intolerable situation. When a man is under investigation, under common decency and under, I think, the ethics of the law practice, those who are conducting that investigation and are privy to that confidential information are to keep their mouths shut. This isn't a trial to go on in public display. This is serious. These are serious allegations that are being investigated. And I think Vice President Agnew is entitled to the same presumption of innocence that you or I or any of our listening audience or 200 million American citizens are entitled to. He hasn't been arrested. He hasn't been indicted. He hasn't been charged. He hasn't been tried. He hasn't been convicted. And I think the man's entitled to his presumption of innocence. And I think he's been very seriously abused, not only by the Justice Department, but I think he ought to broaden his charge to include the White House itself.
He said that the letter bringing these charges out originally reached the Wall Street Journal an hour before he received them.
Hmm. Well, if it did, that's almost unforgivable. If some prosecutor or assistant prosecutor, and I name no names because I have no names, but if somebody is in the high levels of prosecution is leaking things of that type, that's reprehensible.
Do you think the House of Representatives was correct in turning down his request to present his case?
Yes, I do. Bear in mind that this matter was on its way to submission to that federal grand jury in Baltimore, Maryland. Witnesses had been subpoenaed. They're scheduled to appear every week for the next 4 or 5 weeks. Since the normal processes of law were then in process and taking place, I think it would have been unwise at the same time, simultaneously, for Congress than to get into the same situation.
I wonder if we could look ahead now, a little less than 3 years away, to the 1976 Democratic Convention. How do you see the convention in 76 shaping up, Senator Eagleton? Will it be the quota system entirely this time, or will some of the old-line politicians like Mayor Daley of Chicago, will they have anything to say or more to say? Well, they didn't have anything to say in the last one, as I recall.
Yeah.
Will they have anything to say in 1976?
I think the quota system should go. The present quota system says this, that there shall be quotas established for women, blacks, and young people under 25. Okay, you go that far. How about elderly people? Why not a quota for the elderly? All right, how about some of our ethnics in this country? We have so many fine Italian Americans, Polish Americans, Spanish-speaking Americans. How about a quota for ethnics? How about a quota for professions? A lot of people, their profession is their most important thing in their minds. Why not a quota for lawyers and doctors and broadcasters and farmers and what have you? Why not a quota based on religion? How about Catholics and Jews and Methodists? You see, once you get into the quota thing, there's no way to stop it. What we did last time was arbitrarily draw the line at minorities, women, and young people. Well, I mean, it was just a very arbitrary thing. I think the quota system should go. So I don't think we'll ever go back to the tight little convention kind of process that we had, say, during the time of remember, Boss Haig of New Jersey City and Mayor Kelly of Chicago and Boss this and Boss that. No, we're not going to go back to old-fashioned smoke-filled room bossism. But I think the quota system should be changed.
You think it will be?
Yes, I think it will be. It's going to be a struggle. There's still some infighting going on in the Democratic Party. I can't say as I sit here tonight that all is peaceful and harmonious within the Democratic Party. There's some of us at each other's throats. We like to fight in the Democratic Party, but we'll survive these fights. But I think the quota system will go.
How was your telethon a few weeks ago?
Yeah. Well, let me see. What were the last figures? I think they raised something like $7 million. Yeah. I may be off a bit on that, but it's something close to $7 million, which made it the largest political telethon type thing in history. The party was in debt. As you know, we've been heavily in debt since the 68 election, the Humphrey Nixon election. We never even paid off those bills. I'm told by Chairman Strauss that if the $7 million is all collected and what have you, then you have to pay the expenses. That'll retire all the existing debt and leave some money for operating expenses to keep on current bills, which would be very healthy for the party that's been almost bankrupt financially now for 5-6 years.
Would you care to look into the future? We're talking about 1976, about who might be any of the presidential hopefuls on the Democratic ticket as of right now.
Well, starting with the caveat that you included earlier, we're 3 years away from the convention and over 3 years from the election of 76. I would have no different judgment than was reflected by Mr. Gallup in his most recent poll nationwide of Democrats, and these were his findings. In first place was Senator Kennedy, second place Governor Wallace, and then coupled very closely together Muskie, Humphrey, and Jackson. I would say those are amongst the names that are to be considered, and if you had to anoint, say, who's at the front runner right now, bearing in mind that we're way far removed from the time, I'd say Gallup's finding on that Kennedy was out in front maybe is as good as any.
How is the mail that you receive from your constituents? How's it running? What are their problems?
Oh, by far, the issue that overwhelms everything else is inflation. Yes, we get some Watergate mail. We get some mail on some weapon systems. We get some mail on different issues, to be sure. We average somewhere between 400 and sometimes 800 letters a day, depending on just what's hot that given day. But the number one leader is consistently, for now, for the past weeks, has been inflation. We hear it from housewives that are talking about these meat prices and prices of bread and milk. You hear it a lot from elderly people. People say living here in St. Louis at Council Plaza, telling us that, for instance, they live on Social Security, supplemented maybe by a modest pension, what it means to them when these prices go through the roof and their income is fixed and they can't, there's no cost of living increase for them, and the high cost of health services and things they have to pay. We hear from these fuel distributors who are having to pay more for their raw product gasoline and yet are frozen in the prices that they can sell, getting a lot of letters from fuel dealers. And as you know, that's a hot issue right here in St. Right. Louis at the present time. Right.
Anybody concerned about the energy crisis?
Yes, indeed. Oh, yes, indeed. John, if we have a cold winter, you know, about one winter out of every four is a cold one. That doesn't mean it comes statistically that way. That's the law of averages. If this is a cold one, if we have an early winter with cold weather, we're in real trouble. We don't have enough heating oil to go around, and we're going to have to absolutely ration it on a priority basis. First things first, hospitals, schools, homes, etc. I mean, there could be some industries shut down in this town and in this nation. That's the last one on the list is industry. Because, you know, hospitals have to get it first, right. The sick and the elderly and the children have to have warm schools, etc. We're just desperately short of heating oil. Now, we may luck out. You know, the weather, God may be with us and the weather may be mild. And if it is, we'll struggle through. But if it's a bad winter, we're in bad shape.
Well, if we were to have a mild winter and we got through it, would we be in better shape for the winter of 74-75?
You asked the most probing question of all. You see, the energy thing is a two-faceted question. It's the immediate this winter, but it's the long range as well. It's next year and a decade from now. We're short in energy. If you look at the overall pictures, we're enormous consumers of energy. We are 7% of the world's population, and we consume 33%, one-third of the world's energy. Think of that. 7% of the people consume 33% of the world's energy. We're wasteful, and I bet you you're as bad as I am. I bet you drive to work by yourself in a car. In Europe, you see lots of carpools. It's the common practice. Here, it's the exception. When we air condition our house, if we've got an eight-room house, we've got the air conditioning going in all eight rooms, and we're just sitting in one, maybe, you know, or we're in the kitchen or in the den, and we got the other six being cooled. My wife's got one of these self-cleaning ovens. She wouldn't give it up for anything. Do you know what? How much energy that consumes? One cleaning is the equivalent of 60 pounds of coal. One click. Self-cleaning oven, it consumes an energy the equivalent of 60 pounds of coal. So, and our supply of energy is limited. We can produce 10 million barrels a day of oil. Our current demand for oil is 16 million barrels. We've got a gap of 6 million barrels a day that we have to make up. What does this mean? We've got to do a lot more in terms of energy research in alternative energy sources, including coal, of which we have enormous abundance, but we've got to get that darn sulfur out of it. Solar energy, nuclear energy, geothermal energy, oil, shale. We've got to have a crash almost like the space program. A crash program on energy, because it's the problem is getting worse rather than better because we're consuming more and we have less available.
Well, you know, we always are looking to our federal government for all of the answers. Do you think the federal government is to blame that they didn't look ahead far enough to see what was happening maybe 10 years ago,
yeah.
5 years ago?
Senator Jackson of Washington has been shouting from the rooftops for 8 or 10 years on this very problem, but no one would listen. Why? There was no crisis. You see, we're a crisis-oriented nation. We got all worried about smog. When there's smog, people said smog was going to come to Los Angeles and there'd be thermal inversions in St. Louis, but until they occurred, you didn't believe it. Then when you see it, then you get all excited about it. We had to have this crisis, this shortage, with people having maybe their homes not as warm as they want them before we can drive home the point that Senator Jackson's been making for years.
How long will it be before we can solve this during this crash program?
I think the whole decade of the 70s is going to be a decade of short energy supply for the United States. We're going to have a continuing problem for the rest of this decade. We're going to struggle along on a hit-or-miss basis, because you just can't develop a whole new energy, a solar energy system in 1 year. You're talking 10, 20 years. Nuclear We have the technical know-how, but we haven't expanded. There's some safety problems we haven't satisfactorily resolved. So many of these you're talking long range. So we're going to have a troublesome decade of the 70s energy-wise.
Another problem that confronts our nation, we don't hear too much about it now. It seems to have died down, but I'm quite sure that it's still very prevalent, and that's the drug problem that we have in the United States. A lot of people wonder, as powerful as the federal government is, why we cannot control the sources of drugs coming into this country.
Well, it's a legitimate question to ask. Why don't we nip it at the source, is the way they ask. Why don't we keep it from hitting our shores, whether it's coming from Turkey or being fabricated in France or it's coming from Thailand? Well, the truth is, you see, we have a big coastline. All the way from Maine around Florida, the Gulf Coast, et cetera, Mexico, et cetera. And even we have beefed up the border patrols and the various narcotic bureaus. I think we've doubled the manpower in terms of border inspections and what have you. It's just such a darn big coastline that even with the best of efforts, you police it tight as a tick, we'll say, from Boston to New York. They smell that coming, and then it starts coming in south. And they're detecting a lot of it, but some still is getting through.
Well, once it gets here then, Senator Eagleton, why can't we nip in the bud the people who have it?
Well, God, we beefed up the narcotic enforcement laws, and New York, which has one of the most severe problems, the Rockefeller Act is now just on the books that has a very stringent penalties for possession of hard narcotics and what have you. So in terms of severity of enforcement, I think we've gone very far, and we're just going to have to keep plugging away. The narcotic problem, John, does not lend itself to an easy, simple aspirin tablet-like solution. It's a deep, pervasive, frightening problem that's going to take more time to cope with, and it's difficult.
We have about a minute and a half, and we talked about the Democratic presidential hopefuls. Would you care to mention anything in the Republican circles? That seems to be the thing that's being kicked around. We hear about Conley, and he made a famous faux pas.
Yeah.
Did you hear about it last night?
I felt sorry for him because
he didn't even know he had said it.
No, and later on he must have felt like a dime, you know. Sure,
saying
he didn't mean it.
Yeah. And saying be exonerated and found guilty.
Yeah.
Speaking of the vice president, well, a lot of people think that the president is edging Mr. Conley in and Mr. Agnew out. Is there any?
I see the 76 race as a Conley Agnew Reagan fight. And how that all come out, I don't know. I guess I'd have to put Conley in the first place. I'll give you my 25-cent prediction. I can predict, I think, the Republican vice presidential nominee. I think that whoever's the presidential nominee, I think, will pick Howard Baker of Tennessee to be his running mate. That's just my 25-cent prediction.
We have 45 seconds. Let's throw in Senator Percy. I know he's not a friend as of now, I don't think, of the president.
Senator Percy's a friend of mine, but he is not definitely a friend of the president. And I think Senator Percy is a prophet without honor in his own political house. The National Republican Party will never take Chuck Percy as the presidential nominee.
We want to thank you very much for taking time from your busy schedule, Senator, and being with us on our program tonight. It's been our pleasure and honor to have on Information 55 this evening the Honorable Thomas F. Eagleton, Senator from the state of Missouri. For Information 55, this is John Rodell saying good night.
This has been Information 55, another in the KSD series examining the characteristics of our time through conversation with those who shape them.